From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Coming up...
Time is up! Time is up in tech! Time is up at Google!
Google employees around the world walk out of their offices.
Sexual harassment is much more pervasive than any of us ever imagined.
Also today...
Over a span of 20 years, Whitey Bulger could wake up, look out his window onto Boston, and say to himself, I own this town.
David Boeri reflects on more than 30 years reporting on James Whitey Bulger. Plus, the former leader of Dunkin' Donuts says the best companies run on pushback.
I would argue that every company, every organization needs some kind of challenge. I've developed a mind that's like, perhaps I'm not right. And I think you have to open that up.
It's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. Google employees are demanding changes to how the company handles allegations of sexual misconduct. Workers walked out of their offices all over the world today, including in London, Singapore, New York, and in Cambridge.
Time is up! Time is up in tech! Time is up at Google!
WBUR reporter Simone Rios was on the scene in Kendall Square earlier today, and he joins us now. Hello, Simone.
Hey, Cal. Nice to see you.
So these Google walkouts happened all over the world. We saw images on social media of what seemed like very large gatherings. How big was the one in Kendall Square?
Yeah, so when I first got there, there were maybe a couple dozen people. I tweeted it out, and then before I knew it, there were several hundred. I felt like it was probably a large percent of the office, which has 1,400 people currently working there. The impetus for this protest, of course, was a Times article that revealed that Google had paid out $90 million to Andy Rubin, the founder of Android. Rubin left the company in 2014. The Times reported that the year before, an employee had accused him of coercing her to perform oral sex in a hotel room. Google investigated and found that her claim was credible. Google could have fired Rubin and paid him essentially nothing, but instead he landed a $90 million exit package. That was the impetus again. But protesters say that for every story in the Times, there are thousands more that remain untold. Rachel Gray manages a team at Google in Cambridge and has been there for 11 years.
The corporate culture is largely good, but we are clearly not free of problems. We've received some really good news in the last week about the lessening of some of those problems over the last couple of years. I was thrilled to get that from Sundar Pichai, but there are more changes that we want. We want an end to forced arbitration for sexual harassment, especially.
Sundar Pichai, I should point out, is Google's CEO. But this issue of forced arbitration, it's a pretty big deal. These arbitration agreements are relatively common in the industry. Basically, if an employee has signed an arbitration agreement over harassment or discrimination and they later file a complaint, it has to be dealt with internally and cannot go to the courts.
Right. The arbitrator could be a retired judge, but it stays out of public view. It keeps people, you and me, from seeing what's going on.
That's right.
So what else do the Googlers want then, Simone?
So today they issued a statement saying that Google has championed the language of diversity and inclusion, but that substantive actions to address things like systemic racism, inequality, and sexual harassment have been few and far between. There were five specific demands, the first being the arbitration issue, but they want what they call pay and opportunity equity. For example, for women of color to be present at all levels of the organization. But I want to tell you there's something else that I found interesting. And a few of the people I spoke to pointed out the difference between the highly paid tech staff that you have at Google and people who do the work to maintain the offices, the cleaning people, the labor, et cetera. So essentially what they're saying is that temp employees, vendors and contractors should have the same protections as full-timers.
And are those just global concerns company-wide, or did the folks you met in Kendall Square today talk about specific concerns they have about the culture in Cambridge?
Yeah, I mean, the sense that I got was that this was more the former, that this is an all-for-one, one-for-all kind of sentiment. I asked this question of several Google employees, and the answer I got was that the problems didn't seem to be any more or less present in Cambridge than anywhere else. We spoke with Amit Deutsch, a program manager at Google. They told us the culture issue transcends Google, Cambridge, and even Google itself.
I'm angry at the amount of power and abuse happening at the upper echelons, not just of this company, but companies all over the place. I think that has to change. And I'm inspired by the fact that people who have experienced this have decided to speak up. And I'm inspired by the fact that so many of my workers feel similarly and are finally willing to come together around this. And I wanted to be a part of it.
And we heard that Google's chief executive is supportive of these walkouts, or at least not in opposition to them publicly, Simone, right?
Yeah. I mean, I got to imagine it's somewhat awkward for them to see all their employees marching out like this. Google sent us a statement from the CEO, Sundar Pichai. He said employees have raised constructive ideas and, quote, "We are taking in all their feedback so we can turn these ideas into action."
So is this a one-off? I mean, did it feel like this was just sort of a nice rally today, or did it feel like the beginning of something a little bit more substantial?
I wish I had my crystal ball that I could say for sure. But I will say there was an air of idealism among the protesters. I mean, they understand that they work for one of the most powerful companies and influential companies in the world. And this is a pretty unusual event, I think, for, you know, for Google Alphabet, 72,000 employees to just march out and start, you know, airing their grievances about what's happening internally. It's not every day we see an action like this from a Fortune 500 company. Sarah Brown is a product strategy lead at Google in Cambridge. She spoke to the crowd about how quickly this all came together.
I can't tell you how impressed I was to see how quickly Googlers from around the world rallied together after that article broke. Barely 6 days from article to a global walkout. We saw injustice. We took action together.
I do want to add, so it was a lot of the 1,400 employees there today, but I approached five or six people, and no one wanted to talk to me on the record. They were hesitant to attach their names to something that could turn up in a Google search for the rest of their lives, understandably, perhaps. There were three people who spoke at the rally, and when the rest of the crowd was given the chance to do so, you could hear crickets.
So one of those people who spoke at the rally had what sounded like a really powerful moment, Simone, and hoping you can help set the scene for us. This is when organizer Vicky Tardif-Holland was speaking. Take us there.
Yeah, so Holland is a staff linguist at Google, an ontologist, actually, and one of the organizers of today's protest. She spoke about when she first read the Times piece last week. She had just returned from interviewing a young woman who was interested in working in the tech industry. This was how she reacted. Let's take a listen.
The most crushing part for me wasn't the sexual harassment. I know that exists. It was the fact that a young woman was harassed in her job interview. And Google knew, and he was still an employee. So here I am trying to get young women into this industry, and they are being harassed when they walk in the front door. Time is up on that.
So it will be interesting to watch as things progress with Google. Is this just a one-day, a one-off event, or is it going to become something bigger? I do think that if it is going to lead to anything big, that Google employees need to be willing to actually speak up. And frankly, I didn't see a lot of that today, other than the fact that they walked out.
All right. That is WBUR Simone Rios. Simone, thanks for joining us again.
Hey, thanks a lot, Cal.
And I actually want to bring in Vicky Tardif-Holland, who we just heard from in that clip. She is a staff linguist at Google. And again, she led the walkout from Google's Cambridge office today. And she joins us on the line. Vicky, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
So, Vicky, I understand you've worked for Google for the last 8 years, and I'm wondering what you've seen, what you've experienced. Have women been held back in their careers, sexually harassed at Google?
You know, it's hard. There are pockets of Google that are very good and very good for women, and there are pockets that are not, that are very bad for women. And sometimes it's the luck of the draw of where you end up in this organization. You know, we try to protect each other by talking to one another and warning people about problem people, problem groups. But, you know, it's definitely hard. I know of women who have been told they're too abrasive. They need to be nice. And then when they try to pull back on their tone, they're told, well, no, you got to step up and lead. So it's hard to move up in an organization if you don't really know how to behave in a meeting. You know, I've certainly heard cases of people of color being, you know, told that they don't look like an engineer and asked for their badge, you know, do they really work there? I've certainly had people assume that I'm not in a technical role. When I walk into a meeting as a woman, there's this assumption that I'm not there to present on a technical topic, which makes it much harder for me to advance in my career.
You talked about the advancement, Vicky, and I spoke earlier this week with Nilanjana Bhamik. She's a co-founder of the Cambridge venture capital firm Converge. We were talking about those barriers to advancement for mid-career women in tech in particular. This is what she said.
These are hardworking women that are perhaps best in their category, but ultimate success to reach the V level and the C level is also about building your social capital and your political capital. This is also the time where, you know, women are entering motherhood. So it's a tough phase in their life where this critical aspect takes a backseat, and that ends up hurting them.
Vicky, does that ring true for you, what you've experienced and observed firsthand?
I think it's true. I think, you know, as a woman, you don't want to go on an outing necessarily that it's all men. You know, I often am in groups at work where I'm the only woman. This is a social outing. I don't necessarily want to put myself in a position of being the only woman. And quite frankly, not just in this industry, but in pretty much every industry, it's hard to balance being a parent and having a full-time job. And you have two full-time jobs at that point. And so it's really hard to say, you know, I can't go to that networking event because I need to go home and, you know, do bedtime. And so that certainly is a problem that women face, not just at Google or in tech, but throughout the workforce.
Do you feel, though, that showing up to those kinds of social events are tied to your promotions?
I think that not directly, right? I mean, directly, it's about how you perform, but, you know, there are those indirect things of does your manager, your director trust you to take on a project, and some of that trust is social capital, is how well they like you, how well they think you fit the role of someone, of that role. And it's harder if you don't look the type, if you haven't gone to the social events, for them to think of you when they're assigning those roles.
Vicky, I can't help but notice that you're speaking out against your own employer, which a lot of people could see as a professional risk. And so I'm wondering why you do this. What's convinced you that it's necessary?
So as I said at the rally, I've been in tech for over 20 years now. You know, I remember a time of being one of, you know, two or three women in my CS classes. And that's how you picked your lab partner. Like, you're a woman, I'm a woman, let's be partners. And it hasn't gotten materially better in the 20 years since I've been in this industry. You know, we keep being told it's a pipeline problem. We need to recruit more women. We need to recruit more people of color. But we see them walk in the door and get crushed by the system and walk right back out. So it's a leaky bucket. We need a way to make sure that the people come in who are just as capable, just as driven, are actually given an opportunity to succeed. And in that way, it's going to benefit not just Google, but our industry and you know, the country.
It sounds like you're in a tough spot, though. You talked at the rally about feeling somewhat torn about what advice to give to younger female developers. You're trying to recruit them into the industry to solve that pipeline problem you just mentioned, and yet you also don't want to bring them into a toxic environment. How do you reconcile that?
You know, I think it's something that I struggle with. I've talked to other women who struggle with it. And some of it is... I don't blame anyone for saying, no, I'm not going to recruit because of this. And I don't blame people who say, I'm still going to do it, but I'll be very honest about the situation. I think everyone has to find what the right fit is for them. And to be honest, I've changed over time. I've gone from, okay, I'm going to be honest about what's happening and how to navigate these situations, to now, quite frankly, being pretty vocal about not wanting to do interviews of interns or people new in the career, because I don't want to give the false impression that they're going to walk in and every door will be open to them. And I am starting to feel tremendous amounts of guilt about that. And so I want to make sure that they understand what's happening. And more importantly, that Google and our industry step up to make changes so those people are welcomed.
Vicky, I'm hoping you can help us understand the scope of the issue here. I mean, today's event was a Google-specific phenomenon, but you've worked in tech at other companies as well over a couple of decades. So are we looking at a Google problem, or is this an industry-wide problem?
Oh, this is an industry-wide problem. I think people at Google recognize the power that you have when you're a Google employee and are therefore maybe more able to speak out than other people in our industry. I think we also realize that when big companies like Google do things, we can move the needle for the entire industry. So if we can get things like forced arbitration out of our contracts at Google, it gives people at other companies leverage to get them out of their contracts there.
Vicky, we were speaking earlier with WBUR's Simone Rios about some of the demands. We heard the list earlier, and I'm wondering, you know, one of the things that stood out to me is that it explicitly includes all employees. So we're not just talking about the highly paid developers. We're also talking about janitors and temp workers. Why is it important to include them as well?
You know, I think we stand in alongside our coworkers. You know, when someone has a Google badge, I think of them as a coworker, regardless of the color. At Google, you get a different color badge depending on if you're full-time or temporary or an intern. And they work alongside me. I think of them as my fellow colleagues. And it's unfair that they are not given the same protections that I'm given as a full-time employee when we're working in the same building side by side. How can I be protected if the person next to me isn't? And I think a lot of people are getting that and see that full-time employees have a voice that those other people don't, and so we should use our voice to help them.
Well, Vicky, we appreciate your willingness to speak out, as we said, with some professional risk at hand. That is Google linguist Vicky Tardif-Holland. She organized today's walkout from Google's Cambridge office. Vicky, once again, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Stay with us, please. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. As we've been reporting on WBUR, notorious Boston mobster James Whitey Bulger was killed this week in a West Virginia prison at 89. His crimes were heinous, and his violent legacy in this town is long and well documented. And yet there's a lot we don't know. Who's really responsible for his death? Why was Bulger sent to general population in a prison known for violence and understaffing? And there are even larger questions unanswered, including this one. Where does the Whitey story end? Well, perhaps the man who knows more about this than anyone is our own David Boeri. He writes today for WBUR's Cognoscenti, reflecting on more than three decades of covering all things Bulger, and he joins us now. David, hello.
Hi, Callum.
David, let's start with just the latest of what you're hearing today. It's 2 days after Whitey Bulger's death. What have we learned about why he was being transferred to Hazleton in West Virginia? It's not a medical facility, and he'd been complaining about medical care. Was this just a stop on the journey?
What we know is the Bureau of Prisons isn't releasing details here. And the key question is, why in the world was he ever in Hazleton? And so what we know is, this is the timeline I've been able to establish, is as of a week or so ago, Bulger was the federal inmate in Florida. He has a heart condition. He's in severe decline, according to his attorney. He's in a wheelchair. He's unable to walk. He has a vial of pills, of nitrous glycerin tablets around his neck. He had applied for transfer to a prison medical facility like the one we have here on Route 2 in Devens, a federal facility there. His attorney Henry Brennan says Bulger told him over the phone he was going to be transferred to a medical facility. And Bulger notified him again by mail about a week later that he was on his way and that he would contact Brennan when he got to that facility, whatever it was. He didn't know what it was at the time. Instead, he is sent to Hazleton Prison in West Virginia. It's not a medical facility. It's a level 3 prison. It has its maximum security, in other words. It has the worst, most violent inmates of all. So the question is, did they change their mind and reassign him, or was on his way elsewhere? But it would seem like he was assigned to Hazleton. And in order to do that, they would have to declare that his medical condition had improved, which would fly in the face of what the attorney is saying, and the fact that he's in solitary confinement for 8 months, which would not improve the health of somebody with a severe heart condition.
No, definitely not. And David, what do we know about the suspects in the killing?
So one of two men seen entering his cell is named Freddie Gias. He's from Springfield, a guy doing life without parole for a murder. And he's linked to the mafia. He's said to hate informants connected to the Genovese family. So that's the name. There's another name, of course. And I can go through all the names with you. I mean, I spent a long time trying to differentiate between Ronnie the Pig, Vinny the Goat, Joe the Horse, the whole collection of them. And I can tell you, it's Frank Salemi, who's a long, long friend of I'm kidding. He's a long associate of mine. I've spent a lot of time with him. He, of course, was convicted just this last year in Boston. Mafia guy hates Bulger. His associate who was convicted with him is in the same prison. So we can go on asking about, you know, who did it. But for me, and at this point of my coverage of the story, that's a sideshow. That's not what the real story is here.
So if the story isn't the barnyard, what is the real story then?
Well, it's interesting that there's been very little attention on the main question, which is the Bureau of Prisons had a job to do. It was to care and protect for its inmate. Now, Whitey Bulger is not a popular guy. I'm not going to miss him. People hate him and understandably hate him. He was evil and violent. But the fact is, the Bureau of Prisons let him get away. Their job is to protect him. They couldn't even protect him for a single night. He should never, by all accounts, have ever been put in a prison that contains the like criminals, mafia members and others, violent criminals, who have a motive for killing for bragging rights. And what sanction is there for a guy doing life in prison without the chance of parole? None. So it is the question of, and he was brilliant. Bulger was brilliant at this in an evil genius sort of way. He was able to spotlight corruption, incompetence, the posturing, the hypocrisy of government. And here, once again, he's putting attention on the Department of Justice. They didn't do their job. He died in a way he would have approved if he had killed someone else. He died, and that's where the narrative is going. So that's what I'm saying. I think
what U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling had to say, this was the other day, it was the day the news came in. So I have mixed minus there, if you can turn it down. We received word this morning about the death of James Whitey Bulger. Our thoughts are with his victims and their families. Well, that's all well and good. I've stood with the families. I've been with them. I've cried with them. I've seen the tragedy that they face, the outrage of government behavior, government-sanctioned behavior. I've seen all that. But as a U.S. attorney, Mr. Lelling has a responsibility to provide objective investigations and objective prosecutions. He should be talking about getting behind what the hell happened and who put Bulger there, because it looks rancid.
In a narrative sense, though, David, it's kind of a fitting ending, right? I mean, you say the Bureau of Prisons had one job to do here, and they failed to do it. And so you bookend that with the beginning of his reign of terror, which begins with a mixture of incompetence and government malfeasance, right?
Right. Yeah, it's a great narrative. And so we're hearing details that I can't believe that the Bureau of Prisons would normally be releasing or others would be releasing. We find out they tried to cut out his tongue. Well, that, of course, great narrative. They cut out of a tongue that got the tongue out of a guy who was a rat. But the story and the story of this case has always been for me about government who brought us, the government who brought us Whitey Bulger. It imposed Bulger on a whole community, allowed him to commit a reign of terror, and is still ducking responsibility for that.
Yeah, you write a little bit about that on Cognoscenti today, David, about how the FBI, in a way, was deciding who got to live and who died by aligning themselves with Bulger as an informant. Explain that a little bit more.
This was all part of the War on Organized Crime, which was launched in the early 1960s. And this has, I mean, there are long, long legs in this, Callum. But it was the War on Organized Crime. And the target of the War on Organized Crime was none other than the mafia. And so along the way, the government and the FBI starts building informants. And one of the lessons of the story, never become hostage to your informants. The FBI did. And Bulger was chosen. Bulger was developed along with Stephen Fleming, who probably was a more important informant for the government. But they were developed and recruited. So their top echelon informants, whatever they help the government do, whatever they give on the rivals, puts the rivals in jeopardy, has the rivals prosecuted, and they rise. But where it really goes rancid is when now they are protected from others. They're protected from other criminals who might be testifying against them, against informants. And there's nothing more despicable than FBI agents revealing the identity of would-be witnesses to the targets of those investigations. And they did that with Bulger and Flebby, and the results shouldn't have surprised anyone. The informants were killed. They were murdered, some murdered preemptively. And the trails were covered up. I mean, there is nothing more sickening than this. Or to see what happened to the families who were victimized along the way by being ignored, threatened, frightened, harassed by agents, all to protect the reputation of the FBI. Fidelity, bravery, integrity. That's the code word, and that was all soiled.
You know, David, you said earlier that Whitey Bulger was a genius, but in an evil way. And I want to ask you about that idea that he was multiple things at the same time. He had this duality to his character, right? Cold-blooded killer, and yet he apparently had a certain charisma that made some people like him. I mean, I'm thinking of how even in prison, at age 85, he reportedly had developed an inappropriate relationship with a female psychologist. What on earth was it about him that allowed him to influence people in that way?
Well, master manipulator. He had a nice smile. He had blue eyes. Kept a good figure. And in many cases, he would scare the bejesus out of people. And he put a gun to your head and show you the bag that he was going to put you in after he blew your brains out. Winning personality.
It's quite a combo, the charm offensive and when that doesn't work.
That's it. Yeah.
You said earlier, and you wrote about this too, that you won't miss him, but you said you also are never going to shake him off. Why do you suppose that is?
Never going to shake him off because, I mean, that story to me, as I said in regards to what happened in West Virginia, it goes to a bigger story in the sense that it was never concluded that so many people who enabled, empowered, and emboldened him, who took money, gifts, rose in ranks, got fame and prestige, none of them, save one FBI agent, were ever held accountable. There was one agent gave Bulger 40 pounds of C4 explosive, for God's sakes, while he's in the Bureau, not held accountable. Bulger told Kevin Weeks was a surrogate son, told me once, that at any time he could go up to the FBI office, pull six agents out, give them machine guns, and go on a hit. Now, was it true? I don't know. But it's interesting that he could say such things, and Weeks said, I didn't want to ask. But Weeks knew a lot of these agents because they came there. They came around. So, you know, it's the idea. Even the trial never went to the questions the family members wanted answered. And so I've never seen this before in all my years of being in a trial where the defense, where the victims are rooting for defense attorneys who are defending the man who killed their loved ones because they thought that he, the defense, might get more information than the prosecution was willing or trying or didn't try to elicit from its witnesses that would answer more questions.
David, thank you. And listeners, also, thank you for rolling with us as we go through a little bit of scratchy audio there and moving over to the phone. Last thing, David, I mean, when you think back, you know, what would have been a better outcome here? I mean, how could things have been handled better to have more accountability for the death, the crimes, and also the government malfeasance?
I'm sorry, Callum. Help me out. I'm sorry. I'm dealing with a problem here, technical problem. What was it, the question?
I was just complimenting you for rolling with the switch between the line and the phone, so I'll cut you a little slack there. I was just wondering what you think would have been the best possible alternative outcome to have more accountability, not only for the crimes, but also the government malfeasance that that enabled it over the years.
The government fought, in the case of Bulger, in the case of dealing with him, they fought a dirty war against organized crime. They fought a dirty war using him, and this was a problem. It goes back to the very first starring FBI agent long before John Connally. The very first
starring FBI agent on the war on organized crime was Paul Rico. He died in jail awaiting a trial, charges that he committed murder with his FBI informants, an FBI agent himself. That was the first guy. And so the war was along the way. It was dirty in so many ways. And it was the fact that's what you had. And it was a sin. And that was the original sin, and it continued. You know, there's a message that when the government and its agents commit crimes, it sends a message of lawlessness to the land. That's what happened here. And it's the consequence of that war. And really, we never, ever brought it fully to account to warn people in the future. Is it a different age? Absolutely. Is the FBI different? Absolutely. But it's still prone. We are still prone to agents acting in ways that are extrajudicial.
All right. That's WBUR senior correspondent David Boeri. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
And listeners, you can find a link to David's Cognoscenti piece and much more of his reporting on our website, RadioBoston.org. All right, well, if you believe the rhetoric, Massachusetts ballot questions are always high stakes, but we don't always have the follow-up. And I'm joined now by Evan Horowitz, who is the Quick Study columnist for the Boston Globe, and he's been tracking that issue. Evan, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Oh, it's great to be here.
All right, so fill me in. You spent some time digging into past ballot initiatives. Were you actually able to find out how they panned out?
No, because nobody's tracking. It's not that we don't always track. We don't ever seem to track. I mean, I started this piece thinking, you know what, heading into election season, it'd be fun to look back at some of the older ballot initiatives and see if the kind of dire warnings that people issue turn out to be true or false. And the trouble was nobody had ever bothered to check on a whole bunch of them. And it occurred to me, we should really check.
So who should do the checking? I mean, I'm thinking of, you know, we do see, for example, a recent report from Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center that found a 2-year-old law that sets those nurse-to-patient ratios in ICUs in particular has had little effect on mortality and complications, but that wasn't a ballot question, and the assessment didn't come from a government agency. So who should be keeping track?
So, I mean, we have options, but let's do something concrete, right? Like in 2012, there was a ballot initiative, hard-fought ballot initiative over whether auto dealerships, car manufacturers, should be forced to share diagnostic information with repair shops, right? The repair shops are saying, oh, cars are getting really complicated. We need this information. We can't fix it. Okay. So you have a ballot initiative, and we force them to share, right? Did it work? Did it save the independent shops? Maybe. Maybe not. Did it kill the automotive industry? That's what they said. Who should look into that? Well, it would be nice to have some kind of independent agency look into it. We have the CBO at the federal level. Like when Republicans were talking about tax cuts last year or repealing the Affordable Care Act, the Congressional Budget Office, that's the CBO, they were there to provide scores. Oh, here's what we think is going to happen if you pass the law in its current form. And their reports shape the debate. When we're talking about ballot issues here in Massachusetts or laws, we don't have any such agency to tell us what the likely effects are. we could have a partner kind of agency, a CBO for Massachusetts.
So what would be the value? I mean, suppose we do the follow-ups. Let's make the case for why that's important. I mean, does more oversight help voters make more informed decisions on future ballot questions?
Well, okay, two things. Again, let's be specific here. I think it was 2014, but the year's not really important. There was a ballot initiative to repeal the sales tax on alcohol, right? And the promise was this would help liquor sales in Massachusetts. It would be nice to know both whether it helped liquor sales and what it did for alcoholism, alcohol-related deaths, underage drinking, because a ballot initiative really just creates a new law. And if that law isn't working, we should know about it, and then we can fix it. So it would make a difference if we had some follow-up and found out actually there's been no change in drinking or there's been some substantial change in alcohol abuse since we eliminated the sales tax. We should maybe revisit this law.
In the limited time we have left, bigger question perhaps is, are we too reliant on these ballot questions? I mean, I've talked to some voters in reporting on question one about the nurse staffing ratios that they feel like they shouldn't be the ones making that call.
And we had the same debate about marijuana legalization. It seemed like a very technical ballot initiative. Should this really go to voters? I mean, I think the reason that the nursing staffing question has ended up in the hands of voters is because other agencies have failed. That is, it should have gotten solved in collective bargaining. It didn't. It should have gotten solved by the legislature. It didn't. It ends up with voters. That's the bad news. Voters aren't always equipped for these, and we should probably try to solve them in other ways. The good news is, in Massachusetts, unlike other states, the ballot initiatives aren't entered into the Constitution. They're just laws. So if things go wrong, they can be overwritten immediately by the legislature with another law. You don't need another ballot initiative. You don't need anything special. So it's okay that we rely on voters because we make it easy to overrule them if things go wrong. But we better check to see if things went wrong.
That's Evan Horowitz, the Quick Study columnist for the Boston Globe. Evan, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. We all know the slogan, America runs on Dunkin'. But former Dunkin' chairman Nigel Travis says American companies should be running on something else. Pushback. Travis argues companies that implement a challenge culture that provides everyone, from high-level CEOs to brand-new employees, the freedom to speak up and push back, is the best way to succeed in today's rapidly changing environment. Travis is also the former CEO of the Papa John's pizza chain and has held leadership positions at Blockbuster and Burger King. His new book is called The Challenge Culture: Why the Most Successful Organizations Run on Pushback. And Travis was in our studios this week to talk about his book, and we began by asking him to define what he means by challenge culture.
So what I've found is everyone focuses on the challenge word of the challenge culture rather than there's two words there. I actually think the culture is the more important word. But the challenge part, which people do tend to push on probably because it sounds more exciting, is encouraging people throughout the organization to have a say in what goes on in a business or organization. It doesn't have to be a business. It doesn't have to be a for-profit organization. But I truly do believe that by encouraging everyone in the organization to push back, to come up with new ideas, to find ways of doing things, and they can also improve themselves. So that's truly what it's all about.
One of the adjectives you use in the book that kind of wraps that all together is anti-hierarchical, right? But,
yes.
But most organizations do have some hierarchy, at least on paper. There is a chief executive. There are people who rank below that. So how do you accomplish that when there is some hierarchy?
Well, yes, and I'm not saying get rid of all the hierarchy. I think the organization of the future is going to be very much about being flatter. And I think what it really means, anti-hierarchy, is that if you say the CEO or the leader of the organization, people down the organization can talk to you, can give their ideas, but it really means that the leader has to give those people access to he or her. And one of the things I talk about in the book is these coffee chats, which essentially is a very simple concept. I mean, the way it worked at Dunkin' is we talked to all the people below director level. So people would come in, typically 15 to 20 in the room, and we ran regular coffee chats. And what I try to get is people to talk about things. So what I also try to do is by putting some controversial subjects on the table at the start. I would say you may want to talk about sales. You may want to talk about our profits. You may want to talk about the last quarter. But you also may want to talk about the recent rumors about potential acquisitions or, you know, what do you think about the Me Too movement and Dunkin'. So you give people some idea of what they can talk about, and you're trying to create a safe environment for them, for them then to discuss subjects that they wish to discuss. What I find is that people truly build their engagement with the company. They have a better understanding. And a lot of people have a lot of creative ideas. Too many people go outside and hire consultancies to get information. Most of the information already exists in the business. And I think what you're doing is you're tapping in to people at different levels. And I think certainly, I'm 68. One of the great benefits is tapping into people who are younger, who may be actually more au fait with what the consumer is thinking than I am.
So you're in the habit of having these coffee chats, and I noticed that you also have a cup of coffee on the cover of your book. And the old saying is, don't judge a book by its cover. But I do see some significance here, Nigel, which is that Dunkin', under your leadership, sort of increasingly pivoted into a beverage-first, coffee-first brand and away from the core donuts. In fact, we've just recently seen the company drop donuts from the name, which is a change that seemed to begin under your watch. So as you think about that in the context of a challenge culture, how hard was it to change something so iconic about the brand?
Well, I, for one, was very nervous about changing it. It all started about 2.5 years ago. My concern was, you know, to make sure that dropping the donuts part, we weren't going to get big consumer reaction. So we did, I think, 3 different sets of consumer research. I was also very concerned about international. I mean, between our two brands, we're in 69 different markets around the world. And one of the things I've always loved doing is meeting with franchisees and licensees and asking them to vote on subjects. And they all said this was a good thing to do. Didn't mean we did it. We then did more research here. We brought in various agencies to make sure we positioned it. We tied it into our next generation store, and it fitted. But I think the other thing is that the Dunkin' name is seen by consumers as more up-to-date than Dunkin' Donuts. And it does reflect the reality, and this is the point you made, that we're now 60% beverages. So I think it just reflected reality. And here's the good news. Even in the markets where donuts are a huge percentage of our sales, like Southeast Asia, our franchisees have been incredibly supportive and keen to modernize the brand.
So if Dunkin' has evolved to keep up, one of your previous companies is maybe a study in contrast. Blockbuster is the one I'm thinking of. So what did you observe there, maybe even after your own tenure? But what went wrong there that perhaps could have been alleviated by some of the things you learned later on in your career?
I had 10 wonderful years at Blockbuster, and it was a real learning. So your word is highly appropriate. We did a lot of things to keep up to date. I mean, just to play back the tape, every day we got attacked by some new form of technology. I mean, just a few examples. Near video on demand in those days, which was predominantly DirecTV. Every day you'd wake up and there was something that was new.
Redbox or whatever.
Well, I'm going to come back to that because that's a great example. But yes, another good example. The first one that really hit us was Netflix, which was the DVD by mail. This was in 2002, and I actually recall that we kind of dismissed it. We had the opportunity to buy it for $50 million. It's been as high as $160 billion, so, you know, big mistake. We did recover the fumble, so to speak, because we set up Blockbuster Online. It was taking share. It then continued to grow over the next 2 or 3 years, and then Carl Icahn came in, decided that the focus should be on the stores, not the internet. And if you think back, that's not entirely illogical because we went through the whole internet boom, then bust, and there was a lot of skepticism about the internet in the 2000s. I think it was wrong. I think we'd clearly demonstrated that Blockbuster Online could grow, and they continued to demonstrate that after I left. He focused on retail. He then tried to buy Circuit City, and the result was 3 years later, Blockbuster went into bankruptcy.
But was at the time, was there a problem with the culture, a lack of challenge culture that stopped that decision from being made? Or was it just, hey, it was the wrong call?
Yeah, I say in the book, I think we could have done a lot more. We could have anticipated ourselves. But yes. I think vending's a really good example. So we had, let's say, relatively successful vending machines set up in Spain, Israel, and the UK. So we tested it in the US, and it didn't work well. Now, most tests fail because people don't execute the test appropriately. They may not do the right marketing to support the test. So what we failed to do at Blockbuster was to test it effectively. Redbox came along. It then made it highly convenient to rent tapes, then DVDs. They're now doing games. And by the way, Redbox is still around. You know, kudos to them. So I learned a lot of lessons. And I think it was, we didn't have a strong enough strategic process. We probably didn't have, to your question, a strong enough challenge culture within. We failed to test, and testing protocol, I think, is a huge learning from the Blockbuster situation. I think Blockbuster would still have been around today if they hadn't made the mistake of focusing on the stores rather than the internet.
Or maybe buy Netflix.
Yeah. Well, or buy Netflix. Yeah. The interesting thing is I tried to apply all those lessons when I was at Papa John's, where we became the online leader, going back 10 years. And at Dunkin', we've tried to stay ahead. So I'm trying to make sure we don't repeat the same mistake.
But so I'm curious whether you think a challenge culture is really necessary, though, for an organization to succeed, because you write a few points in your book about Donald Trump and his management style is kind of a contrast of what you're describing. His first few months in office were very tumultuous, a lot of staff turnover. He seems to surround himself with folks who prefer to affirm his thinking as opposed to questioning it. And he has enjoyed a lot of business success, Nigel, and he is the president after all. So isn't he proof that maybe you don't need a challenge culture? You can succeed anyway.
Good challenge in its own right, Callum. what I would say, though, is it's interesting. Nikki Haley actually said that you can challenge the president. And if you read Bob Woodward's book, Fear, there is clearly a lot of discussion and a lot of dissent that goes on. I think the point I would make, and I'm not criticizing the president here, I think wherever you are, you have to have an open mind. I would argue that every company, every organization needs some kind of challenge. I think over time, I've developed a mind that says, perhaps I'm not right. And I think you have to open that up. And you have to open up, going back to your earlier question about the hierarchy, you have to open up access to a wider range of people, particularly on critical decisions. I mean, perhaps at Blockbuster, we should have done more research or more discussing down in the lower ranks of the organization about vending, and perhaps we would have chosen to go down the vending route.
I want to ask you, Nigel, Boston is a big startup town, and I'm curious about the guidance you would give for creating a challenge culture at a startup, because it strikes me that if you're the CEO of an old business, you're not really responsible for building that business into what it is today. You're kind of in a caretaker's mm-hmm. role. But if you are the genius who created a company out of nothing, you know, your instincts have already proven to be really good, at least on some level. And so how do you push back against that person who seemingly has such a great track record?
It comes back to having this open mind that life changes, the consumer changes, whatever you came up with, how do you keep it up to date? That's what failed to happen at Blockbuster. So how do you build in challenge to what you've invented should be the goal. It is very difficult for founders, incredibly difficult. But I come back to one of the things I said right at the start. If I was advising someone who was a founder of a startup, I would say, first and foremost, before you talk about challenge, make sure you got the culture right. To focus on the culture you need should be a process where you engage as many people in the organization as possible.
You've talked and written about getting buy-in from mm-hmm. people farther down in the company. And of course, one way to do that is to invite them to speak their minds and ask questions. Another thing is to just pay them and treat them well, right? And I'm curious how you think corporations bear responsibility for doing that today. You know, in Sears' recent bankruptcy, we've been reading sort of these retrospectives about the company. And the Times had an interesting piece the other day about how somebody who worked at Sears decades ago could have retired with, you know, more than $1 million in today's money in retirement, and how difficult that would be to do as a low-wage worker at a place like Amazon, for example. So, you know, on the other hand, they have corporate shareholders as well who they're responsible to. So how do you balance those things?
I think it's a combination. Point one, tougher to find people, truck drivers, people to work in fast food, welders, you name it, particularly here in the Northeast. So what you need to do is create the right culture, I think that comes first. Has to be an engaging culture where everyone at every level has some level of involvement and has the ability to, if you like, say and ask what they think. I think you need to obviously pay well because people won't come, but then you need to incent them well. And incentives could, in some cases, involve stock options or something like that.
That is Nigel Travis. He is the recently retired chairman of Dunkin' Brands, which owns Dunkin' and Baskin-Robbins. He's also the former CEO of Papa John's Pizza and has held leadership positions at Blockbuster and Burger King. And the new book is called The Challenge Culture, Why the Most Successful Organizations Run on Pushback, and presumably Dunkin' as well. Nigel,
absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kellen.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Zoe Mitchell, with help from Eve Zukoff. Tim Skog is our technical director, with engineering today by Max Liebman. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.